On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome the director of tonight's film, Tom Hooper. And you're blushing a little bit right now.
Thank you for that response.
One of the things I said in the introduction, I just mentioned to you backstage, that this feels to me, this film, like the concluding part of a trilogy between King's Speech and Les Miserables and this. And you had an interesting reaction to that when I said that.
You're the first person who's made that observation. No, I meant that in a good way.
Thank you, Tom.
there is something interesting that at the center of all three movies, the films speak about the transformative possibility of being loved. For Jean Valjean, that it's that scene with the priest when Valjean is to his amazement, the priest lies on his behalf and forgives him, and that moment of kindness to a man who'd been degraded for two decades and brutalized, and creates a kind of extraordinarily burning epiphany where he discovers faith, discovers love, and commits his life to living it in a loving way. And the King's Speech, you know, you have this man who's very, very blocked through his stammering, and it's the loving friendship of Logue, and it's the love of Helena Bonham Carter, his wife, that helps him overcome it. And this film, I suppose, you know, we all have blocks in ourselves between us and the best version of ourselves, or the true version of ourselves, whether it's shyness, insecurity, addiction, depression, stammering like in the King's Speech. But to not identify with the gender you're assigned at birth surely is the most profound of blocks one can imagine a human being facing, and a potential cause of such distress. But in this film, it is, given the time it's set, given the 1920s when there was no sort of roadmap for transition, I think it was only this extraordinary marriage and this love in that marriage that created this space for transformation being possible. So in that sense, yes, I think you're right.
But also, too, occasionally I'm right. But also, I was saying to you, too, they also seem to be about being trapped in these roles and trying to break these boundaries of these conventional roles, be it royalty or once you're assigned, especially in that period, if you once you're poor, I mean, you're basically a criminal. And here, just that idea of that line between gender and sexuality, these idea of breaking out of these assigned roles and in some way creating a kind of situation where people have to learn something about you as you're learning about yourself. That connects the three of them for me, too.
Yeah, I mean, and I also, it made me think about the roles we're assigned at, I mean, the identities we're assigned at birth, whether through race or religion, you know, so we grow up with constructs or inheritances that affect us. But, you know, I think in this film, gender and, you know, it was interesting to kind of make clear the difference between gender and sexuality. And yet I do wonder whether there is a complicated relationship, because I wonder whether if Lily was alive now with Gerda, she would feel free to live as a lesbian couple or stay married as two women, which wasn't possible. And in the days when she lived, there was no possibility of that. And I feel that Lily felt the pressure to be, you know, to not stand out and to be a normal woman, and therefore to be a normal woman was meaning to be a heterosexual woman. And even though I've made the film, I never felt I fully got inside the complexity of whether her sexuality was part of her process, you know, her sexuality as a choice was part of a process of validating herself as, quote, a normal woman, or whether that was, you know, she was able to freely express herself in that way.
But these three movies too, and I mean, harp on this, not move on, but they deal with the way people are judged superficially. Once you're seen, the way people see you is the way they think you are, and that idea of going beneath the surface connects these three films as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm drawn quite often to outsider figures in my films, and I don't know why that necessarily is, but people have been marginalized. I mean, I think back to John Adams, which I directed for HBO, and you know, he's one of the founding fathers who kind of feels he should be one of the famous ones with Washington, Franklin, Jefferson, and Adams, and for some reason, Adams isn't part of the four. He's part of the three, and he was acutely conscious of that failure to be iconic in the way he wanted to be. And you know, it's interesting why I keep getting drawn to people kind of suffering marginalization.
Yeah, well, also since you bring up Adams too, that idea of finding a way to dramatize loneliness is something that appeals to you too, and that interests me.
Yeah, loneliness or sort of loneliness in the frame. I mean, I sort of find the frame an interesting thing because you can kind of get the audience to forget the frame and make the frame invisible, or you can remind the audience of the presence of the frame in order to strand a figure in the frame, and you can use the edge of the frame to confront a character, or you can want the audience to forget it, or you can play with both.
What was the first thing you shot for this? Because I just found myself thinking, as you're talking about that frame, when we first see him, he's in that corner and you're kind of looking down at him a little bit, and he's trapped and people are laughing. He doesn't quite know what to do with him. So we can sort of see then, we get a sense of discomfort, and also how he's just really kind of this prisoner of an outer image.
Well, the first thing we shot, we managed to shoot the two apartments in chronological order. So we started in the Danish apartment and we began at the beginning with Gerda coming in and waking him up, and that playfulness, which was you know, a nice way to begin. I mean, after that, we then jumped all over the place. But you know, we had a 3-week rehearsal, which allowed us to go through the whole film chronologically and for the actors and myself to kind of mark out where they need to be at different points, so that we knew when we had to go out of sequence, we had a kind of a strong sense of where we needed to be.
How far back does that go for you, having that kind of, or having rehearsal time in general when you're shooting?
I think my relationship to actors changed profoundly working with Helen Mirren. I remember doing Prime Suspect with her. I was like, I don't know, 26, 27, quite a young director. And I remember like the second day I had Helen, and she came in the morning, and I said, you know, good morning, you know, Helen. I've got this track laid, it's 30 feet long here, and I want you to walk from here to there because the camera's going to track along, and there's these beautiful perspectives that get opened up. And she gave me a look and said, well, why am I walking? And I said, well, no, but the camera's going to go along and we've got these beautiful perspectives. And she gave me another look and said, well, yeah, but why am I walking? And I said, and then I kind of stopped, realizing that I couldn't defend. And she said, I think I'd be over there by the window smoking a cigarette. And then I thought about whether I was going to take the now Dame Helen Mirren on. And I kind of thought, actually, that's a better idea, because, you know, this character's meant to have given up smoking, and maybe it's more interesting that she this moment of rebellion. Anyway, I realized that she had a much better idea than I had, so I had the sort of embarrassment of telling my, you know, much wiser and older grips that they had to pull up this big track. But really, I learned that the really great actors come to the set with a vision of what they want to do, and if you don't at least give them the chance to do it once, you'll never know what that was. If the moment they walk in, you put them in a box because of the camera needing to be in a certain place. So I learned to be much more light of foot about how to place the camera and not to put the pressure on the actor of saying the camera has to be here, and giving them the space to create freely.
Did you have that long rehearsal time on the King's Speech as well? Did you have 3 weeks?
Yeah, we had 3 weeks again. Les Mis, it was a musical, so we had 8 or 9 weeks. But actually, on The Danish Girl, Eddie started preparing a year out, and he prepared pretty much full time for a year, apart from the odd distraction of a film called Theory of Everything, which kept getting in the way.
What was that again? I don't know if I quite know that film. Okay. But you were saying before that you actually started, you got this script about the time you were preparing The King's Speech, right?
Yeah. Actually, before I answer that question, there was a funny moment 2 weeks into the shoot where Eddie was very keen to have a long weekend off, which, you know, I thought was a kind of outrageous request. And then he said, well, there was this little matter of the Academy Awards on Sunday, and I really can't come back on Sunday night. I've got to fly back on Monday. So I said, okay, that's fair enough. So Tuesday morning, he comes straight back from the airport and you know, how was it? You know, what's it like to win an Academy Award? After about 5 minutes, I'm kind of sneaking looks at my watch, and he noticed me sneaking looks, and he looks at me and he goes, we should crack on, shouldn't we? And I said, yeah. And that was it. And what was amazing about Eddie is there was no sense that he wanted to have a month for a victory lap or even a week. I mean, he couldn't think of anything better than get back to work. And the fact that he went through all that in those first 2-3 key weeks of the shoot, when we were doing all the most emotional scenes, and I would have thought he just had a holiday if he hadn't told me. You wouldn't have known him. He's an extraordinary disciplined person.
When did you first meet him?
We first met doing, he was like 22-year-old actor on Elizabeth I, also with Helen Mirren as a theme. And he played a young rebel who rebels against Queen Elizabeth I, Queen Helen Mirren, and is obviously sentenced to death. Because you don't rebel against Helen Mirren. And in this moment of you know, I shot this two-camera setup of him reacting, and it was extraordinary. It was like watching someone being sentenced to death. You had the insight of, oh my God, this is what it would be like as a young man to have your life cut short and not have realized the implications of your actions and the implications of your hot-headedness. But it was his emotional rawness and this emotional translucency he had that was so extraordinary. And, you know, most English actors are in some kind of dialogue with their own reserve, you know, or they're emotionally repressed. Not like English directors, I assure you. We have a very fluent contact with our emotions, as you can tell. Watching this extraordinary raw performance of this actor, in that moment, I thought, if I can ever cast him as a lead in a film, I'd love to do it. But going back to answer your question, how I came across this film, it was 7 years ago I fell in love with the script. I was in early discussions of doing The King's Speech. It was late 2008. My wonderful casting director, Nina Gold, I was chatting about how I couldn't find any good scripts, and she said, I know of one great unmade script, and it's called The Danish Girl. But on this project, 7 years makes me a bit of a newbie. It was my producer, Gail Mutrix, who's here in the audience, I think. For her, it's been a 15-year labour of love to get it made. We had a rather traumatic lunch meeting last year when I decided I want to wait 4 months to shoot the film to wait for an actress called Alicia Vikander. And Gail literally broke down in tears and said, sorry, Gail, I hope you don't mind saying sorry, but, you know, saying, because she thought finally she was going to make the film, and then she had to have another delay, and she thought it would never happen. And I still keep reassuring her that it's happened. So, Gail, please, can this be evidence that you've now got a finished film?
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
For me, there's often a character, be it Michael Sheen or Jeffrey Rush, who has kind of an emotional immediacy in you, and like who's feeling everything right away. And it's
you mean the non-English person?
Yes. or the English person acting like a non-English person. But yes, and I just wonder, it sounds like that's what you responded to in Eddie, that immediate access he had to his emotions.
Yeah, but actually I thought you were talking about Alicia, because I mean, it was a dream to me to cast a Scandinavian in this film, because obviously if I had been a properly method director, I would have gone off and taught myself Danish and then made it in Danish, and you would have seen it in 10 years. Or maybe it wouldn't have got released here. But anyway, I made it in English, but to find an actress who's not only Scandinavian but had played a member of the Danish royal family in a royal affair rather brilliantly, I thought was great, because I worried that with an English actress and opposite Eddie, the whole thing might become subconsciously some kind of moratorium on Britishness, and Alicia brings this incredible kind of Scandinavian freedom and energy and drive to it and fearlessness that doesn't feel wrong to me, remotely British, and allowed that quality to come in.
I was thinking about that as you were talking about that early scene where they're in the bedroom together, and you can see that the effect that she has on him, that the kind of couple that they are, and you just really see the difference in temperaments and what they bring out in each other. And Gail, it was worth the wait to get her.
No, it's funny, because people sometimes will say, you know, what's it like to shoot a sex scene? And in this particular case, it was, you know, it was kind of the cliche that the Scandinavian actress was just completely relaxed, up front, uninhibited. And Eddie and I were the ones sort of, you know, finding it incredibly hard to sort of say, you know, what body position we might want people to adopt. But I learned something from her. It's much better just to be direct.
Well, one of the things I was mentioning to you too, that I'm often struck in your films by the long passages without dialogue. And I wonder where that comes from for you.
I suppose, you know, for me, if you think about the scene in The Peep Show, which is perhaps one of the things I'm most proud of in the film, you know, that's a non-dialogue moment, but it is, you know, Lucinda Coxon described it brilliantly in the script. So it's sometimes I think people don't realise the role writers have in setting scenes that are non-dialogue as well as the others. But for me, it's not just about dialogue. It's also about not overusing music. And Alexandre Desplat, who wrote the wonderful score for this, is unusual in composers, and he's often lobbying to write sort of less rather than more. And it's I do think silence is slightly kind of underrated in cinema going. And I do think it's partly for practical reasons. I think, you know, when a cinema chain is really driven to sell popcorn to make money, that's noisy. How do you master noise? You have a noisy soundtrack. When you're watching a quiet film next to an action movie in the next door screen, you can hear the action movie through the wall. So it's a very good idea to have lots of music so you don't hear the action movie through the wall. So I mean, I can understand why noisy cinema has grown up, but you know, I think stillness has its place.
Yeah, because I was really struck too by the moments of violence in your films, like the scene where he's walking through the park and he's accosted by the guys, and it just, we can sort of feel that turn and that great last shot where the camera's kind of spinning and he's on the floor of that gazebo. Talk about staging that scene, because it's really harrowing to watch.
It has an upside down shot in, which slightly happens by accident, because if you're, when you have a steady camera and you want to get it super low, the only way to do it is to spin it so that the camera ends up upside down. And you normally say, well, we'll flip it later on. But you'll notice there's a shot in this where the camera's upside down. And also in John Adams, it's the same. There's a shot in the last episode, but the same thing. But I thought Lucinda Coxon, the writer, said a very interesting note to me about the scene, which is that when we're talking about why Lily throws the first punch, and it was, Lucinda said, it's almost as if he's, by that stage, he's got a death wish. He's inviting the violence against him. His self-esteem is so degraded by that point. He's got such a nihilistic place that he wants to invite a beating, which connects to the next scene where he talks about suicidal instincts with Hans. But the construction of the scene is lovely, because it starts with Lily being proud to be called a lesbian by the thugs. So you know it's beautifully structured in the writing, because you don't see where it's going to go.
And I guess I was thinking about that scene too, where he's visiting the psychiatrist and he just happens to look down at the assessment. And again, that's another really hammer. That seemed to me almost feels like something out of Hitchcock.
Thank you.
I mean, did you know that that was going to be like something that would build this kind of interesting tension, or because you could have played that any number of ways?
Actually, interestingly, there was some sort of humor in those scenes with the psychiatrist, and it was a very, when I shot them, there was humor in the script, and I wasn't sure whether that was the right time in the film to deploy humor. So we literally shot the scenes both ways, one with an eye for that, and one to take it serious. And in the end, you know, my editor, Millie Oliver, and I felt that we needed to take it more seriously. But I mean, because in the end, that the judgment of the medical establishment was incredibly important. I mean, what in the memoirs, Man and Woman, that Lily Elba left behind, there's an extraordinary passage where, in all seriousness, she's debating the merits of being lobotomized versus having gender confirmation surgery. And she's quite, in the diary, she's quite torn between two routes, and that, which is shocking when you think about it now, you know, to seek to place yourself in a near vegetative state mentally, or to try the surgery. The fact that those seemed like kind of 50-50 choices at one point for her.
Wow, because I just wonder, you say you saw that script like 8 years ago now almost, and if there were a number of changes, or if that was the version of the script that you shot, the version that you saw.
We definitely did some, we commissioned, I mean, Gail, who's here, commissioned some great original research into Lillian Gerd. It was very, very hard to get at the facts because there's never been a book written about them. You know, David Ebersoff had done research, but then he'd fictionalized his account of them. So through that research, we changed some things to bring it closer. But I would say in the main, the film is a love letter to the quality of that piece of writing that I first read, because it, like a good theatre script, it didn't fall apart in your hands. Rather, it taught one the way to go. And I think a good example of that in practice, of a script teaching you something that you maybe was, you hadn't grasped, as do you remember the scene where Gerda comes home and Lily is sitting at the kitchen table, and Gerda is completely astonished because they decided that Lily wasn't going to come again. This is sort of early on in the movie, and the first line in the script is, "How are you?" And Alicia, as you know, the sweetest, most loving, kind person, even she said, "Is that really the first thing I would say? Surely I would feel betrayed. I would feel hurt that my husband had." Was living this secret life, and suddenly here's the evidence of it. And in the end, I sort of said, let's just imagine the script's right. And if it's right, that means that Gerda has an extraordinary selflessness and compassionate facility that's maybe beyond our instinctive ability to grasp, because she comes home and she doesn't see, you know, her husband in woman's clothes. She doesn't see betrayal. She sees her partner in tears, and all she cares about is how that partner is, and the fact that she says "How are you?" as the first line is the beautiful thing in the scene.
Yeah, I mean, so much of these movies are about finally these acts of generosity, aren't they? I mean, between King's Speech and Les Misérables, and then this. I mean, these moments like that that make you feel that something is really happening are just kind of extraordinary.
I mean, you know, I think Gerda's. I mean, in some ways, I think the film is a kind of exploration of unconditional love, because, I mean, real love is about genuinely caring about the other person more than yourself. And I know that's not a popular thing to say in 2015, when real love is often mistaken with the love you put into deploying a version of yourself online. But no, the film at its core is an expression of the kind of kindness that flows from really, and in some ways the sacrifice, that's where the sacrifice comes from, because, I mean, yeah, there's that terribly cliched adage, if you love someone, set them free. But I mean, Gerda, in loving Lily that much, knows she may lose Lily as a result, and yet still supports her.
I guess I want to ask you too about the costumes, because strikes me as being the most difficult part of this. I mean, we've got to believe that they're this kind of amalgam that inhabits that line between gender and sexuality, but they've got to feel like clothes and not costumes.
Well, Paco Delgado is, I think, a bit of a genius. He was Pedro Almodovar's costume designer for many years, and I met him doing a Captain Morgan's pirate ship commercial.
Sorry, what? You were doing a what? You're not getting away from that easily. You were doing a Captain Morgan's commercial.
Yeah, in Spain, in Cadiz. And he was, you know, the main man in Spain, and I met him, and he was extraordinary, and so we did Les Mis together, which was his first sort of, you know, break doing a big sort of studio picture, and I think Paco, you know, Paco found it really interesting, because when you look at the photos of the real Lili and Einar, they were particularly Gerda. Her sense of fashion was extraordinary. I mean, way ahead of its time. But you also got a tremendous sense that there was a real interest in dressing up, in creating costumes for the paintings. And so through that, one realized there was a particular space of freedom and license in the marriage in relation to clothes, which would have, again, helped Lily emerge.
Yeah, because even that scene with the beating, he's wearing that beautiful, those silk pants and that beautiful sort of herringbone. I just, please don't get blood on those clothes, because they're so beautiful.
No, I mean, you know, that what was really interesting in the photographs of Einar that Gail found through these researchers was there was a sort of phase in the middle where Einar was living as Einar, but she had slightly raised heels, she had a tailored waist, you know, she consciously decided to feminize herself as a man, and I think that suit was a reflection of that.
Because, I mean, you almost see that, you could think of, I was finding myself thinking about the new romantic period in British pop, where they had that same kind of thing with the cinch waist and the bigger shoulders and all these things that were basically about presentation and some ways just defining yourself in the ways that people didn't know.
But also, if you think about that era in British pop, again, it's about rebellion and the fact that, you know, men deploying feminization in their dress could be seen as so subversive and rebellious. It speaks to, I suppose, the history of the complexity of gender politics.
Let's thank Tom Hooper for being here today.
Thank you.
Catch up on past episodes with the treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.